Morning, it's 11 o'clock. I'm Rosina Cini, live on the BBC Asian Network and with you for the next hour. Now, did you know any 40-something computer programmers that are handy with a Kalashnikov and have met a have a six-year-old child? Anne Singleton has a past that's unlike most people. She fought with the Iranian Mujahideen in Iraq for 10 years, attempting to overthrow the government. And I'm going to be talking to her about her experiences and the lessons that she learned. What was it like to be part of a terrorist organization and fight in the desert? How did she get involved with them in the first place? Get your calls in 08459 440 445. But first the news with Kalpana Badu. It's Rosina Cini with you. And it's 10 past 11. I'm really looking forward to speaking to my next guest now because she's got a fascinating story. Her name's Anne Singleton. She lives in Leeds. She's got a six-year-old child and she's a computer programmer. So, what I hear you say, but Anne has got a past that's unlike many others because she used to be part of the Iranian Mujahideen, training in their camps in the deserts of Iran and preparing to overthrow the Iranian regime in Tehran. So what happened? How did Anne get involved with a terrorist organization that was hell-bent on invading Iran? What lessons did she learn? Anne joins me now. You can get your questions into Anne, by the way. 08459 440445 is the telephone number, and you can text us 81869, or you can email the phone in. No gaps between the phone and in, so all one word, the phone in at bbc.co.uk. Good morning, Anne.
Good morning, Rosina.
Let's start from the beginning. How did you first get involved with the Mujahideen? And for those that don't know, just explain who the Mujahideen are.
Well, the Mujahideen are an Iranian opposition group. They formed in 1965 in opposition to the Shah's regime. And then after the revolution in 1979 in Iran, they tried to take a share of power in the country. And when they were confronted by the Khomeini regime, which was established at that time, they left Iran and took up a base in Iraq, which is where I trained. You said Iran, but in fact it was Iraq.
Ah, okay, my
apologies. Sorry, it's quite an important distinction. And since that time, they have been allied to the Saddam Hussein regime in fighting against the Iranian Islamic Republic. And trying really to replace the Islamic Republic with a regime of their own. It is an armed guerrilla outfit, always has been. It started off as an armed group, and that is the group that I got to know when I was at university.
So what makes an English lady get involved in this?
There's two things. One is that at the time of the Iranian Revolution, it was a very political time in the world. El Salvador had a revolution. Chile was in turmoil. There was a lot of activity going on. The political scene in Britain was changing. So it was quite an interesting time for everyone, I think, to see how world events would turn out. It happened that I had Iranian friends at university, had an Iranian boyfriend. He was religious, and so he got involved with the Mujahideen, which of course was an Islamic group.
Did you convert to Islam?
I had already converted before I knew them, yes. I was not a very strongly religious person, but yes, Islam made sense to me, and I converted and was very interested in finding out more. I think that belief, that interest, was kind of hijacked by the Mujahideen, because they were more interested in the politics of Iran rather than increasing people's religious awareness.
So was it a gradual process of indoctrination done through Islam itself? Did you go through it very quickly, or was it quite slow?
I think my story is quite unique in a sense, because I was recruited by this organization by default. I have to say that they were actually recruiting Iranian students, and it just happened that their techniques also worked on me. And then because they weren't actually targeting me, I think it took a little longer to recruit me than it would have taken to recruit if they were directing their efforts at me. And It takes about 3 or 4 days to actually recruit somebody into an organisation like this. And I have to stress at this point that this organisation operated as a cult. It wasn't just an ordinary political organisation.
So what kind of methods did they use then?
What they start off with, they start and hook you with a message. The important thing is that they said to me that there is a regime in Iran which is violating people's basic human rights, and that they are repressive and reactionary, and their version of Islam is very, very inhuman. Now, they came to me with the message that our version of Islam, the Mujahideen Khalq's version of Islam, is progressive and liberal and freeing for people. And so that was the basic message.
And you had just embraced Islam then, and you were indeed. You were coming round to that kind of way of thinking, were you?
I was, yes. And I was quite intrigued by the events in Iran, because here was a revolution unfolding before my very eyes, and I knew the people who were involved, and their families were in Iran, and it was a very kind of, in a way, very exciting but also disorientating. But what really recruited me into this organization were the people, not the message. If they'd just left it at the message, I would have been happy to help them in small ways. But what they do, they will they get their people to come along and flatter you. They will say to me, for example, that you understand more than ordinary people, you have a greater sensitivity to our issues, and you're just not an ordinary person, and therefore you need to do more because you understand. And so they would ask me to go to demonstrations down in London, outside the Iranian embassy, or just holding big demonstrations. And then eventually they would invite me back to their safe houses in London. And alongside this, the way that they did this was to create an atmosphere in which you couldn't ask questions, in which you'd never had enough sleep, you didn't have enough to eat, you were always uncomfortable, and they were bombarding you with information. And all this was disorientating, and so you're kind of more open to suggestion.
Well, what was the response of fellow people in the group? Were they all Iranian, or were they non-Iranian people like yourself that were being indoctrinated at the same time?
At the time I was involved, in the early 80s, there were, of course, they targeted Iranian students and Iranian refugees, and so most of the people there were Iranian. But there were many, many non-Iranians who, for example, were married to an Iranian person. Yes, they were helping out as well, and they were giving up their education, giving up their lives, and giving everything they had to this organisation.
How was your relationship with your boyfriend? His name was Ali, wasn't it?
That's right.
Yes. How did your was it better now that you became part of this group? Did you become closer?
Our relationship suffered greatly because they tried their best to recruit him and he tried to resist.
Ah, that's interesting that you and joined and yeah. He didn't.
Indeed. That's why we split up, because it got to the end of the 80s and I had become so indoctrinated and so much, this organisation had taken over my whole life to the point where I was comparing everything in life to them. There was a very black and white version of life in my mind, and I saw that, I believed at that time that they were the only possible hope for the world, in a sense. And so I said to my boyfriend that I will go down to London and I will help them out in a greater degree. And he said, no, I don't want to go, I want to just get on with our life and let's start a family and let's go on like this. And so I left him and went to London and joined the Mujahideen full time.
Did he ever tell you you're being brainwashed? Did you ever think for a second that it was brainwashing? Well, obviously you mustn't have done.
I have no idea. Nobody has. I mean, the way these organisations work is such that you believe that everything you're doing of your own free will, and that you are happy to be doing it. In fact, what I was suffering as a full-time member was sleep deprivation, emotional abuse, mental abuse, and yet I felt that I was happy. I felt I'd chosen to do the things I was doing.
What did your friends and family think of it all?
Well, they were very dubious about the organisation. They could see that the people that with whom I was mixing were very sincere, very self-sacrificing and very educated people, but they couldn't understand why a white middle-class English woman who had no kind of involvement with Iran at all in her whole upbringing, why was I so involved? And they couldn't understand the obsession that I had. And my parents kept saying to me, you know, that why don't you just help Amnesty International, for example, if you're concerned about human rights. But I was totally taken over by this point. I mean, even by the early 80s, I was taken over to the point where I believed sincerely that my parents had no idea about anything, and that I had the answers to everything.
0845 9 440 445 if you want to put a question to my guest this morning, Anne Singleton, who lives in Leeds. She's a computer programmer, but she's had a very unusual past, if you like. She used to be part of the Iranian Mujahideen training in their camps and preparing to overthrow the Iranian regime in Tehran, and she's telling us about how it happened, how she got into it. So if you want to put a question to Anne, do give us a call, 0845 9 440 445, or text us 81869, or email the phone in at bbc.co.uk. Anne, you mentioned that they were bringing you round to their way of thinking about how the world was. What was their thinking of the way the world was?
Well, on the surface of things, the Mujahideen present themselves as quite pro-Western, pro-democratic, pro-feminist. They present a woman leader. They have promoted women to their leadership roles. But the organisation which I joined, I mean, I'm talking about their Western front, this is what they present to the world. Inside themselves, they have always been anti-imperialist, they basically want to set up the Rajavis, who are the leaders, they want to set them up in power in Iran. The organisation is a totalitarian organisation inside itself, and their stated aim is to overthrow the regime in Iran and establish what they call a kind of pro-democratic Islamic republic of their own. But from inside the organisation, I don't think anyone really can believe that, because they are so profoundly undemocratic and profoundly exploitative of people.
Now, you've described them as a cult, and the way in which they operated was very much like a cult. Just describe why you think that. Were you like a part of a big extended family?
Absolutely, yes, yes. I think that's how they would like to see themselves. A cult, you can characterize it by several means. It has a self-appointed and non-accountable leader who is usually a charismatic person, and that would be Masoud Rajavi in this case, who, when you listen to his speeches, is a very charismatic speaker. You can get quite carried away on the kind of emotions that he will arouse in you. A cult forms a very elitist and totalitarian society among itself. When I was with the Mujahideen, I believed that we were above normal humanity, that we were somehow the vanguard of civilization and evolution. The leaders used to speak of spiritual evolution, that we'd reached the stage now of we'd reached the end of physical evolution, and now they were leading us into some kind of spiritual evolution. So they were separating us off from normal society. That included separating us off from our families, our friends, and the outside world in general.
You mentioned I mean, you've kind of tried to answer this question, but for me it's still something difficult for me to comprehend, which is why, you know, a middle-class English woman would become so heavily involved with the Mujahideen, and you mentioned they try and cut you off from friends and family. What was going on in your life at the time? Was there some sort of void you were trying to fill? What attracted you to them in the first place?
I think on a personal level, I found them very friendly. Yes, they were extremely affectionate toward me, and very, very inclusive. They didn't condemn.
Was that something that wasn't happening to you in your life outside university?
I think for most people, life is a bit of a struggle. You have friends, you fall out of friends, people judge you. You know, life is not straightforward. What this organisation did was to present a very, very, you know, the most loving people, the most friendly people, the most compassionate and understanding and caring people. And this... they were almost too good to be true. In fact, they weren't true. This was all deception. And they used these deceptive methods to recruit people and maintain the membership. The way that cults work is just based on deception. And they will use kind of physical techniques as well as mental techniques in order to control your environment.
So you got deeper and deeper, and you got more and more involved, and then in the end, I mean, you also went to a terrorist training camp in the Iraqi desert. What was that like?
Well, if I can just briefly explain that, I joined the Mujahideen full-time after a hunger strike, which we held in 1990, as part of a demonstration about the human rights situation in Iran. And hunger and sleep deprivation are classic recruitment techniques, which of course I didn't know about. And so by about day three or four of this hunger strike, I was in a state of heightened awareness and in a different state of mind, to the point where I gave up everything that I had, quite literally, my house, my car, my friends, my family. I gave up everything in order to be a full-time member of the group. Now, as a full-time member of the group, I was completely in their hands. I put myself in their hands. I believed it was a voluntary thing, but of course I'd been manipulated into this state of mind. And from that point, I was given various tasks to perform. I was working something like 16 or 20 hours a day. I didn't get paid. I didn't choose where to live, what to wear, what to eat. Every aspect of my life was controlled by the organisation, and I had no concept whatsoever while I was with them that I was so totally, totally under their control. I really did believe, and I think everyone around me believed, that we were doing this out of our own free will, that we believed in the cause so strongly that we were prepared to sacrifice everything. Now, it came to the point where I was asked to undertake military training, and of course this organization's whole raison d'etre, if you like, was to overthrow the regime in Iran, and so I had no reason whatsoever to imagine that I wouldn't be doing some military training at some point. And of course I agreed, and we went as a group of about 50 people to Iraq. And we went to a place called Camp Ashraf in north of Baghdad. And we were separated, men and women, and we were given our military training.
What did that consist of?
Well, at that time, it was basic military training, which you would get in any army, where you are marching, you are learning how to do your... they do the... what do you call it? The assault course training. You were issued a Kalashnikov, you learned how to fire it, how to load it, how to clean it, We learned how to drive heavy vehicles, and that was a basic thing. But from there, what the organisation was doing, which I again was totally unaware of, they were watching our performance, our commitment, our submission, how far were we willing to submit to their demands. And from the group that I was with, they selected about 5 or 6 women and some more men, I don't know how many, for further training. And that is how an organisation like this works, that they may train 100 people, but from that 100 people, they will take a few of them to the further step and the further step and the further step. And of course, the end game is suicide missions.
Well, we'll come to that in a moment, and you eventually did manage to get out of the situation. We'll find out how after we get the latest news and sport headlines with Kalpana Abadou. In Excess and Afterglow on the BBC Asian Network, 11:36. My guest this morning is Anne Singleton, who lives in Leeds but has had Mujahideen training in the deserts of Iraq, preparing to overthrow the Iranian regime. And just before the news and sport headlines, you were describing how you got involved in those camps in Iraq and how you got to that stage. Just describe to me what a typical day at the camp was like.
The camp, we had a military uniform, and we woke up in the morning. We had breakfast very early, and then we would... It was very disciplined. You had particular tasks assigned to you. One day we would go and do marching drill. Another day we would go and do the assault course training. We had classes in which we learned about basic military activities. Throughout my whole experience of being with the Mujahideen, every moment of my life was programmed by them, and you know, having come out of it now, I find that quite hard to believe, that I was so, all of us are so totally controlled.
And I mean, did you watch videos? Were you still not eating enough, sleeping enough? Was that the way they continued to control your behavior?
Inside the Mujahideen, there is a constant bombardment of indoctrination that comes through meetings, it comes through film. For example, at dinner time, every evening they would show films. You were not allowed to see anything or hear anything or read anything that didn't come from inside the organisation. Very, very strict censorship in that respect. And the films that they showed were films which glorified violence. A very simple example is of a film that was from the early 80s of a female suicide bomber inside Iran who blew up one of the Ayatollahs, and they had film of this, and it was quite graphic film to the extent where you could actually see body parts flying around when the explosion took place. The first time I saw it, as you can imagine, I was horrified. It was horrific. And I looked away. I remember looking away and thinking, I really, really wish I hadn't seen that. And then they showed it again and again and again and again. And they
until
would
you became desensitized by it all.
You know, what is important is the peer pressure that's involved here, where everyone in that room, when this happened, would jump up and cheer and say, hooray, what a marvellous woman this was, how fantastic she was, and full praise, to the point where you began to think, yes, okay, she did her job, she was a devoted member, and maybe I should be like that, maybe I should take on those characteristics.
You seriously considered that perhaps one day you may also... be a suicide bomber?
I had no intention. I mean, to be quite honest, I had no intention whatsoever of killing anyone or being killed. However, what I didn't understand was that that wouldn't have been in my hands. When I was in the training camp in Iraq, if they had at that point, if the Mujahideen leader, Masoud Rajavi, had at that point said, right, we are now going to launch an attack on Iran, I would have gone. I like to believe that I wouldn't have, but deep in my heart I know that I would have not had the will to resist.
No, do continue. Do continue. I'll come to my point in a second.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say the indoctrination is so overwhelming and so constant that you never have time to pause and think. And as I say, they created an environment under which there was no external input at all, to the extent where, as I say, I wasn't even in contact with my family much. If my mum sent me a letter, I was watched while I read it, so that they would understand what was in it.
What was the punishment like if you did go against anything that they didn't want you to do? So what if you had sneaked off and read the letter and been caught?
The punishment was very subtle, but it was very, very strong. I've mentioned peer pressure, and it is one of the mainstays of a cult, an organisation like this. Now, if I did anything wrong, for example, I have always enjoyed walking out in the countryside, and so one day I went out and I took a walk, and I didn't tell anybody where I was going, and I just spent an hour outside walking, and for that they didn't speak to me for days, and I had no idea what I had done wrong, but for days nobody would speak to me. I was basically sent to Coventry, and that was quite
a punishment in itself.
Horrible, because this, don't forget, was all I knew as a family, and I trusted them, I loved the people, I felt they loved me,
yeah.
and that was my world, and so that punishment in itself was harsh enough. But of course, as a Western English woman, they were very softly with me. Other people who were in the organisation, who, for example, were based in Iraq, had much harsher punishments meted out to them, and to the extent where, when the Americans invaded Iraq in 2003 and they opened up Abu Ghraib prison, the Iraqi political prison, there were members of the Mujahideen in that prison, around 50, who had been sent there because of their dissent. So, yes, punishments could be extremely harsh. People have been killed. People have lost their sanity in that organisation. There's a whole catalogue of very, very harsh human rights abuses.
So what was the turning point then when you thought, no, this is wrong, this, what's happening to me is not correct, I don't want to be here anymore, I want to go back to my friends and family?
If only it had been that simple. I did not reject the organisation as such. What happened was that the organisation had what I would call forced marriages, where people were expected to get married to somebody, and they performed this as a duty. Now, in 1990, they reversed this to the point where they had forced divorces, and everybody in the organisation was required to divorce. If you were married, you obviously divorced your spouse. If you are not married, then you would be expected to mentally and emotionally divorce, sort of on the understanding that you would never get married and never have children.
Right.
And that was in order to get you to devote yourself 100% to the leadership, with no distraction, no other emotional ties.
Married to the Mujahideen, if you like.
Married to the leadership of the Mujahideen, mm. Yes. You devote yourself totally, and you divorce yourself from your sexuality, which is impossible. Now, what was happening was I was struggling with that. I had never imagined when I joined them that I would not get married and not have children, and I couldn't submit to this requirement. So I struggled and struggled, and I felt that I was failing. I never at any point questioned whether this was right or wrong. It's incredible to me now how somebody could you know, I could just not even question whether their demands were legitimate or not.
Yeah.
And I left, I walked out, because I felt I had failed them. And it's only
really?
When I walked out, absolutely, and they never, you know, that's what they made me believe, that's what they wanted me to believe, is that I was a failure, and that if only I could just submit to their requirements, then I could remain as a mujahid. Now, I walked out, and it was only when I walked out that I began to start to think more clearly about what on earth they were asking me to do. And even then, it took me 3 years to separate myself, because all the time they were put in place the recruitment techniques again. The ones that had worked in the early 80s were now being resurrected, as it were. the friendliness, the flattery, the feelings of guilt, the peer pressure, all this kind of techniques which they'd used to get me in the first place, they continued to use to get me back. Now, in 1996, I cut off completely from them. I couldn't accept them anymore. And it's only at that point that I started researching into what had happened to me. And I got a label, which was cult. And I began to see that what the Mujahideen Khalq organization was doing was the same as other cults, and that there are other organizations out there today acting in the same way. And I was quite horrified, to be quite honest.
It's fascinating, though, to hear how, you know, this fear of not being able to have children was like the switch in your head that made you realize, actually, I can't continue like this. The wanting of, you know, the desperation of wanting to be a mother in the future was what did it for you in the end. Is it as simple as that?
I don't think it's as simple as that, but yes, that was a very large part. That why could any organisation deny you a basic fundamental human right, which is to get married, to have children? On what basis are they making that demand? Well, it wasn't just that demand. When I left them and I looked at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which of course is from the United Nations, I realised that I did not have one single one of those rights accorded to me as a member of that organisation. And that I was held, as they all are, they still are, in a state of modern slavery. But I, at the time I was with them, I didn't question that they had a right to demand that I didn't get paid, that I had no time off, that I had no family contact, that I had no chance of marriage, no chance of having children, and that my only purpose was to sacrifice my life for this organisation.
How easy was it to get back to life again after what you'd been through?
It was extremely hard. It really was the hardest thing I've ever done. I had to learn humility, for one thing. That sounds strange, but as a member of an organisation like this, the Mujahideen, you believe that you are superior to the rest of humanity because that is what they want you to believe. Yes, that's how they get you to perform these self-sacrificing acts, that you are somehow better than ordinary people. And therefore, I had to come down, and I got back to work as a computer programmer, and I worked among people who were just ordinary people, and I said, well, that's me. I'm like that too. And so I had to kind of relearn being a person.
How did they react to you? Did they think you were a traitor? Did anyone ever call you that at any point?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, they're still
really?
Swearing at me and cursing me and trying to discredit me in every way they can. They will accuse me of all sorts of things, yes. So yes, I'm public enemy number one, I think, for speaking out. It's as simple as that.
And is it still difficult to do kind of everyday things? Are you still haunted by the images you've seen, like the video that you were forced to watch, things like that?
It's 10 years on now since I finally left them, and I have worked very, very hard with my husband, who is also an ex-member, to come to terms with what happened to us. And I think the birth of my son really kind of pulled things around for me, where I realised that he was the future generation, and I had to just kind of put this behind me and put my face to the future and get on with bringing him up as a good, decent person.
Do you think it's easier to recruit someone if they're younger or if they're male or female? Because you said earlier how you, along with a number of other women, were picked to carry out further training.
I think there's people believe that it could never happen to them, and they somehow think that the only people who get recruited into these organisations are somehow inadequate, or they're stupid, or they are not well educated, or they don't believe in something. I think what I have learned is that cults can recruit just about anybody. Now, there is qualification to that, because it doesn't happen to you just at any old time. Yes, when you're younger, you're more vulnerable because you don't know as much. You're also quite idealistic, I think, when you're young. You don't have the kind of experience. You don't get as cynical when you're young. But what organisations like the Mujahideen will do, they'll target people who are intelligent and educated, who are skilled, who can actually bring something to the organisation. Now, it's become a trend, I think, to recruit women, and that might be a bit of a generalisation, but I think that a lot of organisations like this are waking up to the idea that women can actually be an extremely valuable resource. They're far more easy to manipulate. I'm sorry to say that as a woman myself, but emotionally they are much more easy to manipulate. And so I think there is a greater danger at present to women, yes.
How do you think that as a society we can prevent, for example, young Muslims from becoming radicalised, like the 7/7 bombers, if you like?
Yeah, I think that we have to draw a distinction between radical ideas and radical actions. I mean, I think it would be very wrong to say to people, you can't or shouldn't have radical ideas. Of course you can. But what you must not do is mix that up with terrorism. Terrorism is not a belief system. Terrorism is a tool. It's a method of creating conflict in society. Islam is also not exclusive to Islam. It has, in essence, it's got nothing to do with Islam. It's exploited by Islamic groups, yes. Mm. But terrorism in itself is a tool of waging war on society. Now, for young people, they have to make that distinction and say, yes, I can have quite strong and radical beliefs, but I have to test them out in society. Once an organisation comes to you and says to you, right, we have the answer to the world's problems, there should be an alarm bell going on in your head saying, hey, you know, how come throughout history no one organisation has had the answer to everything? And if you are approached by people who do try to separate you from society or separate you from your family, they try to take you into an environment where you are not given answers, where you're not allowed to think or question what they're telling you, then you really need to be thinking that this is not an ordinary organisation and walk away.
So some people would say only weak people get recruited into these organisations. What would you say to them?
I would say no, don't think that. When I was in the Mujahideen, I can say that the people in that organisation were probably among the most educated and intelligent of that society. They had come to Britain as students mostly, and they were highly educated, clever people. Recruitment techniques in cults will work on just about anybody. In fact, I think you'd have to be sort of a very hopeless person if they didn't work, and in which case being stupid and perhaps a bit mad might save you. No, you are recruited not by people telling you great ideas, you're recruited by methods. Mm. And that's what you don't understand, is that it's the methods. You know, when you're going into these a meeting, for example, it's the dark room, it's the claustrophobic atmosphere, it's the kind of chanting, or the techniques are what are recruiting you, not the ideas. I don't say the ideas are not important, but certainly what I was told in the Mujahideen were lies, but the way I was recruited were by methods.
Well, it's been fascinating talking to you, Anne. Before I let you go, though, I do have to ask you whether you've got a political stance on the situation between Iran and Britain at the moment. I mean, how can the British government get their sailors back, and is, you know, Iran a threat?
Well, from my perspective, all I can say is talk. Go and talk to each other, please.
I think there's a lot of that going on.
Well, you know, there is a danger of people standing on their high horses and sitting on their high horses and saying we're right, and when in fact what is needed is more diplomacy, more contact, more involvement between different countries.
Anne Singleton, thank you very much for joining me this morning. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Absolutely fascinating story.